The St. Olaf Choir, hailing from Northfield in the state of Minnesota in the United States, are touring South Africa at the moment, and this coming week they'll be sharing various stages with some of our local choirs. The choir has been directed by Dr. Anton Armstrong since 1990. Welcome to Fine Music Radio, Dr. Armstrong.
Thank you. It's so good to be with you today.
Now, Dr. Armstrong, I was reading up about the choir itself and you as its director for the last many years since 1990, and I found it so interesting that the current conductor, and there's only been a total of four conductors for this choir that was founded in 1912, which I think is quite extraordinary, and also the fact that each conductor studied under the previous conductor, which I think
That's
is fantastic.
Correct.
Yeah. Do you think that this helped the tradition and the sound and the, branding of the choir in the years?
Well, I think it has. Obviously, the founding conductor set the model, but then his oldest son, Olaf Christiansen, followed F. Melius Christiansen, the founding conductor. F. Melius Christiansen was a Norwegian who came to the United States at the age of 18 and came to St. Olaf College in 1903 to formally develop a music department. And in 1912, he founded the St. Olaf Choir. His son, Olaf, who had established himself already as a choral conductor at Oberlin College, followed his father and had the choir from 1941 until 1968. And he was followed by a student of his, Kenneth Jennings, who had sung in the choir from 1946 to 1950 and returned to the faculty in 1953 to direct two of the other choirs on the campus. And then I was a student of Jennings. I sang in the St. Olaf Choir from 1976 to 1978. And when he retired, I was appointed conductor in 1990. So I'm in the final stages of my 34th year as conductor. And I do think that continuity, having experienced the choir in many ways from the inside, gave us, each of my predecessors, a unique understanding of the ensemble. But each of us has opened a new door for this choir in terms of repertory, in terms of tonal production. We've expanded that initial foundation that F. Melius Christiansen so beautifully set.
That's quite a rich history for a choir, especially a choir of that age and standing. I quickly want to ask you about your own entry into the world of choral music. You were born and grew up in New York, which is quite a big city, lots of people in New York City.
Yeah.
And you and your mother sang in church choirs, and you later joined the American Boy Choir in Princeton, New Jersey, which is also very close to New York. Is this where your love of choirs was ignited?
It really was. I've often said it lit my fire for choral singing. And I had my first experiences as a conductor. When I was a member of the boy choir, there was a certain piece. I was the head boy my final year. We had a new conductor who had come from Canada, but didn't really understand much about American folk songs, and especially the Negro spiritual, and we were to do one. And when it wasn't going well for him, I said, I know how this should go. And I did in rehearsal, and he said, well, you'll conduct it. So that was my first opportunity in a touring situation to do that. But that really did light my fire for ensemble singing. And one reason I chose St. Olaf, it was known, though, nationally for its fine choral program. Mm. And so I went a long way from home to go to college, but it was an incredible experience, and it gave me a firm foundation in the work I'm doing now. But that experience in the American Boy Choir was the thing that just made me fall in love with choral music. Several days ago, we were in collaborative concert with the Drachenberg's Boy Choir. Mm. I first experienced Drachenberg in 1996 when the American Boy Choir School brought them to the United States and featured them on a national choral conference. And actually the present conductor, Vaughn van Seil, was part of the touring group that year as a staff member. And he and I met last year when I was visiting Drachenberg, and we put the connection together where we had known each other. And so that concert this past Wednesday was a great event and a fun event for me personally. Again, the two boy choir worlds intersecting.
I think that's so beautiful that it's come full circle, that you started there and then you had the experience of coming back to the Drachenberg. I think that's beautiful.
Yeah, wonderful. It really was.
So Northfield, where St. Olaf College is, as you said, it's in the state of Minnesota, and it's a smallish. I mean, I think if you had to compare it to New York City, is a
Oh.
town more than it is a city. It must have been quite a change of scenery for you coming from New York to Northfield.
Yes, it's there's no comparison. The city of Northfield was about 20,000, and the city of when you do the full five boroughs of New York, you're talking about 8 million people. So it was quite a culture shock. But Northfield has been my hometown for 34 years, and it's we actually have another wonderful college, tertiary institution, Carleton College. So this small little town has the riches of two fine liberal arts colleges. And we're only about 35, 40 minutes south of the Twin Cities of Minneapolis, St. Paul. So we're in a very wonderful area. And if you can stand winter, cold winters, then you do very well. I've learned to tolerate cold winters. My parents, my DNA says I should be in much warmer weather because my father was born and raised in the British West Indies in Antigua. And he came to the United States when he was 18. My mother was raised in St. Thomas in the U.S. Virgin Islands. So my DNA basically says I'm in the wrong place, but 34 years, it's been a wonderful home.
You've had enough time to adapt to the weather conditions, I would say.
Yes, yeah.
Now, coming back to the St. Olaf Choir, how would you describe their sound, and how do you choose the music for the choir?
Well, one reason the St. Olaf Choir became so important in the 20th century choral movement is that F. Mélisse Kristjánsson established a new paradigm for choral singing. In the United States, up to that point, you either had, well, the college university level, either glee clubs, which were social clubs, really, that sang, or you had large oratorio societies that did works like Handel's Messiah or Mendelssohn's Elijah. And when F. Mélisse Kristjánsson formed the St. Olaf Choir, he built the repertory upon a cappella choral singing. He did that for a number of reasons. He felt, first of all, that music without instruments allowed the voices to come through in a very natural, and they didn't have to fight with the balance of instruments. Also, at the time, the college didn't have maybe a strong instrumental ensemble to accompany, but certainly on the touring, it was a lot easier to tour with 60 to 70 voices and not have to have a whole truck full of instruments to cart around. But that model for a cappella choral singing really changed the face of choral music in America. And I would say, since its inception, it has been a pace setting and a role model for choral singing throughout the states and recognized internationally. But what we've kept, I think, from that, we've expanded. My predecessor, Kenneth Jennings, already began to use instruments, at least piano and small chamber ensembles on our touring programs. I have continued that and have expanded that. We do also, while the majority of our music comes from sacred repertory, we do have secular works included in the programs, and you'll find that in this program that we're bringing to South Africa during this tour. But it was a combination of several other things. It was a combination of a purity and a beauty of tone. So we don't ask for a straight or a vibratoless tone, but we do ask for a tone that the vibrato is centered, it's free and always released. And I think certainly with Jennings and myself, we've been even more conscious of performance practice, so that as we do different styles of music from different regions of the world, we attempt to replicate what would sound best. So there's not just one sound. I think of choral timbres and choral vocal tone as being multifaceted. Now, these singers are primarily between the ages of 19 to 22. And at this point, they're still developing voices in many ways. We put them in a vocal section which allows their voice to sing freely and in a healthy fashion. But it has always been one where the sense of the ensemble sound is highly valued. So this is not a choir for a bunch of soloists, though we have solo quality voices, but it's a choir that wants to sing in ensemble and that we also work beyond the music to be one voice. To sing in a sense, whether we're in four or eight or 16 part music, that there is a unanimity to our vocal sound and to the sound, and it's a free release sound, very much in the bel canto tradition.
It's very obvious that you have worked with voices for many years, and I think the knowledge that has been handed down from your predecessors also is very obvious, that they worked with voices for very long. I think it's so wonderful that all that knowledge gets handed down but also developed to be current in the age we find ourselves in. It's wonderful to have that kind of a knowledge and sharing that with people.
Well, my initial training was as a vocal soloist. I have a undergraduate degree from St. Olaf College in vocal performance. And I wanted to be, I know at times, especially in the United States, choral directors are sometimes attacked by voice teachers saying that they were not using the voice in a healthy fashion. Mm. I did not want to do that. I wanted to understand the mechanics and the anatomy of the voice so that I could ask singers to do healthy things in the rehearsal and their performance, but also to have a versatility of sound so that when we sing a Palestrina motet or a Bach motet, it may sound one way. And if I do Verdi or Rachmaninoff or gospel music of the Black tradition, it's going to have a different sound. And so to find a variety of colors in the voice and to explore that. And that makes music very, very beautiful for the creator and for the listener. Our first two concerts, we worked with Michael Barrett, who was at the University of Pretoria. And one of his pieces is featured on this. And we had a coaching session with him. And at one point he said, you're doing some things right. But he wanted us to use a brighter, more forward production and part of the piece based on the language we were singing.
Okay.
And so that type of work over the years, I think, has allowed us a versatility of sound. But we still stay, I think, rooted in a free release bel canto tone quality with good diction. And I think the other thing is that these young people, we work very hard to tell the story of each piece. We're not just singing a piece to show you the excellence of the vocal technique. Mm-hmm. No, we're trying to very, very much be the composer and text advocate of each work, and each work has its own identity, and we try to bring that through in our performance.
That sounds absolutely fascinating, Doctor. I can chat to you about this for much longer, but let's move on. I want to ask you about competitions. I find conductors and choirs there are always two camps. There are the people who feel competitions are unhealthy and they're not good mentally and just have a negative impact. And then there are people who feel that competitions are actually quite healthy. They drive a good state of finding and bettering yourself and your choir and your voice. Where do you stand on competitions?
I'm in the first camp, quite honestly. Mm-hmm. For me, great art doesn't, you're not competitive in great art. That you leave to the sports and the athletic people. When we are doing our work and creating our art, it's one, not to beat somebody else. Mm-hmm. Our work is to develop our gifts, our talents, in this case vocally, at the highest level so that the music serves other people. It serves the artist, but it serves the listener. When we start talking about competitions, we then go back, unfortunately, to an athletic model where there's a winner and a loser. Mm-hmm. And for me, if we are doing our art in a healthy and in a non-selfish way to bring beauty into the world, which it greatly needs, then we're all winners. And I understand colleagues who feel competitions help their programs, and I, in some ways they do. They give the performers a goal to reach. And I think that's admirable. But I think about how many others have prepared to be in that same event. I think emotionally, it's a bad model to follow in developing your groups. I think we should be doing it for the sense of worth and service to others.
Okay, all right, there you have it. That is, I think it's a very balanced approach to competitions. I think it's an interesting topic, and I think both of them have pros and cons, like you said.
Yep.
I saw a social media post of your concert with the Tix Camerata, the University of Pretoria Camerata. As you said, you worked and had a concert with Dr. Michael Barrett, and you were singing Mortimer, and I was wondering, it looked like everyone was having a lot of fun, which they normally do with these songs, especially when there's choirs coming together. That's what I like about a choir festival. It's this very festive atmosphere.
Yeah, I should just say to you, I love choir festivals. Mm. I just hate when people are given prizes and other people aren't. I love when we bring our voices together, and that's what happened both with Tux Camerata and then when the first concert we ended up having with the Cueva vocal group,
yes.
Sabela Mentembu was the conductor of that group. It was two wonderful ensembles coming together and enjoying and being uplifted by our distinctive artistry. And yeah, there was nothing but joy on that stage because we were not competing.
Yes.
We were there to share our songs together. Yeah. And as my students have discovered in our singing and our study of South African choral music, the whole body sings.
Yes.
It's not just the voice, the whole body sings. And that's something as an African American we find in gospel music, we find in the spirituals. But when the Western European canon takes over and you just stand still on a stage and sing, well, no. And this is one reason that sometimes the same old choir these days has often been critiqued because they actually move, sometimes in a very choreographed way, but even when we're not doing a more choreographed movement, as you saw in Mouvement, their bodies are swaying because it's natural. Yeah. It's not natural to stand on a stage and be stiff. It's not.
No, I absolutely agree with you. And especially if it's such a festive atmosphere, I don't think anybody would be able to stand still and just sing like that. But you learned, I think this is probably not the only traditional African piece that you learned. You said that you had, was this a piece that you mentioned that you were working with Michael, that he was giving you a class on how to do it? I don't know if this was his arrangement, though.
It was his arrangement.
Oh, what's this? Okay.
This setting of Mouvement was his arrangement. And he had a version of it on YouTube. So we were able to study that. And he made some slight modifications when the two groups were together. The same thing with Sabelo and Ntebu. His work, he also had sent us pronunciation guide. But then also we had a later performance, a more recent performance of his group. And so we used that as a model. And then as we worked, they slightly modified certain things. They said, no, you studied as well, but I've changed a few things here. And that's wonderful.
Don't you love those just before a concert changes to a piece of music that you must quickly learn?
Well, yeah, very smart and fast learning students. And they loved the changes. Mm-hmm. Both conductors cited why they had change from maybe a previous version of this. I love when I'm doing a piece that I maybe recorded 10 or 15, 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And somebody will come to a concert and they said, we're so glad you did that work, but it's different from, it sounds different. You did. I said, I'm a different person than I was 15, 20 years ago. Otherwise you could have just, put the recording on and we could have lip sync. No, my life has changed. I bring new understanding, new insights.
Yeah.
And so we were very happy. And I forewarned the students. I said, each of these composer conductors may have had different thoughts going through their heads from the time we saw those videos. And it was absolutely delightful to see that.
Yeah. And also, I think once they've heard you perform and heard you sing and had a rehearsal with you, they hear something in your sound and in your singers' voices and maybe think, oh, this will actually work a little bit better with your singers or with some voice group. You know, it might be a little bit better.
Yeah.
I was wondering, how did they find all the clicks in the isiXhosa and Zulu languages?
Well, again, young people today, I don't know how old you are. I'm in my 60s now, and these young people are listening to such a wide array of music from all different styles. And so that part of it, we did some practicing. We had some South African students who attend St. Olaf College, and one of them came back to do some coaching on the diction, and that helped us to do the music with greater integrity. And she also helped us with the clicks. And so when we got over here, quite frankly, that's not the thing that either one of my colleagues had to critique or change. In one case, they said you could be stronger with a click.
Mm-hmm.
It was there and be even stronger.
Yeah.
Every student who graduates will have had to study a language, no matter what your major is. And many of them study abroad at different points in their 4 years. And so language and adapting to new languages is not something that is foreign to them. And they're very bright and quick. This program is actually, maybe in my 34 years, the program that I'm using, I think there may be three or four different languages. There have been many, seven or eight in a given concert.
Okay.
So this is easy for them in some ways.
But like I said, watching that post was just, I just got excited because it looked so festive. And I think that's what it's all about, is having fun.
It was. It really is. It brings a joy. We are at a safari camp, and last night the staff of the kitchen and the restaurant came out and sang for us. And they sang several pieces, and in return we did emo for them. And the ululation that went off when we got to certain of the movement points was so exciting.
Yes.
And so I think for these students, I keep encouraging them to use all of their bodies in their singing. They have some very clear examples of this. And this is not the first time. We were in the hotel we stayed in Johannesburg. The first day that most of the choir, we had difficulty in getting here because of weather and other things with one of the airlines. But again, the staff, the front desk members of the kitchen staff came up and they sang for us. And so I keep saying to my choir, this is a singing people. You sing every day in your life. You don't do it because you go to either you're in a choir or you go to church maybe. People sing as part of their livelihoods and their daily living. And I think that has been a marvelous example for my students as well.
You describe it so beautifully, Dr. Armstrong, and it's so true that it is a singing people in all the cultures. And you know, there are various cultures in South Africa, and that's what makes it so beautiful. And in all those cultures, singing is part of the culture. It's part of people, how people express themselves, how they deal with things. And I think what makes the traditional African pieces, and I think it's could possibly be the same with the spirituals, is that those movements wasn't thought out for a concert. Those movements come from when they were learnt as a child. Those are the same movements. The music comes with its own movements. And I think that's what, whenever you perform a song like that to people who know that song and who know the movements, I think that that makes such a strong connection. And that in turn makes a concert, even if you're the only choir performing, gives it that festive, almost like a choir festival atmosphere. I think it's so cool.
Well, there's a great deal of joy every time we get to the pieces that are clearly from South Africa. The audience emotes with incredible enthusiasm. And that's been, we get a little bit of that in the States, you know, maybe at the very end of the concert. But throughout the concerts we've been encountering, and the audiences here have been large and enthusiastic.
Yeah, that's the kind of audience we like, indeed. So talking about the concert, we've been talking about your previous concert, but let's quickly talk about the concerts that's coming here in Cape Town. You have three concerts coming up in three different venues. What, in terms of your program, in terms of your repertoire, can audience members expect?
Well, the concert's in four sections. And for each of the first three sections, I begin with a piece from South Africa. I wanted, first of all, to set a tone. And we are beginning with the African national anthem, as known as Nkosi Sikelel' Afrika. And it's been interesting. In several of the places, people would start to stand. The other day in Drakensberg, not only did they stand, but then the Drakensberg boys started singing. They had they knew a slightly different version, but it drew people in right away. And I wanted to purposely, at the beginning of every section, to give the South African people music of their culture, showing homage, respect in that way. But I also wanted to give them music from the American culture, and more so in even our own country. The Western European canon has been so strong in the United States. And now in these last, I would say, 8 to 10 years, there's been a stronger push that, especially more marginalized voices, and by marginalized voices, I'm meaning people of color, I'm meaning women. These voices are being heard more and more in our concerts, especially our choral concerts. So I've introduced in this first section two pieces, one from a 19th century hymn setting, Come Ye That Love the Lord, but the arrangement I'm doing is by Alice Parker, who just died in December at the age of 98, and one of the great arranger composers. And then a piece by the African American composer Florence Price, praise the Lord. She's known in our country in her vocal music more for her settings of spirituals and such, but I wanted to represent her art music. Also, I'm doing music from Latin America, from Venezuela, a newer piece by Alberto Grau, who's still living, but it's a piece he wrote a year ago when German conductor Helmut Rilling was celebrating his 90th birthday. And Rilling has been one of my mentors and had great influence on me, not only on the music of Bach, but in so many other eras of music. And then in the second section, I'm bringing a great deal of music from the United States, including two movements from a song cycle that Afmalius Christiansen wrote. He was very much of a neo-romantic, so you get that feeling, but also works that have relevance to today's society. There's a piece in that section called When Memory Fades, and the text by theologian Mary Louise Bringle deals with the issue of memory loss, people who have dealt and suffered from dementia, Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. And I make a point of asking the audience every time I do it, how many of you know or are dealing now with loved ones or friends who are suffering with these diseases? And to see three quarters of the arms, hands go up, it's amazing. And the text is poignant. My own mother had Alzheimer's the last 8 years of her life, and I wish I had had this text 20 years ago when we were dealing with that as a family. And in the third section, after intermission, again, I begin with the piece by Sibelo Mantebu, and then works by several recent composers still living. B.E. Boykin is an African-American female from Atlanta, Georgia. Her piece, Holding the Light, is in this section. Also a work that actually was a surprise to me. It was a gift to me on my 30th year as conductor, If I Can Help Somebody. The original song is by African-American woman Alma Androso. The arrangement was made by Dr. Andre Thomas, and Dr. Thomas and I have been friends for 47 years. He is he was for 34 years director of choral activities at Florida State University, and was the first African-American to be elected president of the American Choral Directors Association, which is the largest choral association in the world, and first to hold that thing. But Dr. Thomas is, as I said, a dear and a longtime friend, and he wrote this as a gift to honor me on my 30th year. This is a piece that was often sung at the rallies by Martin Luther King Jr. Mm-hmm. Alma Androso was a friend and a supporter, and Dr. Thomas has written and arranged things for me over the years, but when this was given to me as a surprise, he said, I don't want to do another spiritual. I want to write a piece that speaks about how I see this man, how he saw me as a friend. Mm-hmm. And the text is, if I can help somebody as I pass along, if I can cheer somebody with a word or song, if I can show somebody he is traveling wrong, then my living shall not be in vain. Mm. If I can do my duty as a Christian ought, if I can bring back beauty to a world upwrought, if I can spread love's message that the master taught, then my living shall not be in vain. And it honors me in one way, but it also gives, I think, a strong lesson to these singers and hopefully to the audiences. You don't have to do great things in this life, but if you do just the simple things of being showing kindness and justice and love, the world would be a better place.
And it's so simple, isn't it? Dr. Armstrong, thank you very much for your time today. I really appreciate you making time to speak to us.
I'm looking forward to returning to Cape Town and this time bringing this wonderful choir that I have been privileged to conduct. Thank you so much.
We're looking forward to it. All the best.